Inks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We're returning to Jimmy Carter. President Jimmy Carter is the founder of the Carter Center and a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
My own belief is that the so-called Arab Spring or Arab Awakening has been potentially a very good move. In all three countries that I mentioned, which the Carter Center has monitored every election, it's been a move from dictatorship to freedom and democracy. And we may not approve the leaders that the people elect. I think as time goes on, every one of those institutions of government will be more moderate, more accommodating to the outside world because of our own potential benefit economically and politically.
Would you please comment on Turkey's role on the stabilization of the social and economic landscape in the Middle East? Do you see Turkey as a role model for secular democratic governments in the Middle East?
Well, Turkey, as you know, is potentially going to become a member of the European Union. I hope it will. The Turks have made a great strides in my political lifetime, which is not all that long, in becoming more moderate. They have abandoned their military dictatorship and moved to a government of a Muslim nature, but it's quite moderate in its attitudes. I think Turkey has worked harmoniously with the United States government. The Turkish government has. And they have become, I think, a stabilizing factor. In fact, when I go to Egypt and read their newspapers or hear their comments on radio at night or television, they quite often refer to Turkey as a model for the future government of Egypt. So it's setting a fairly good example. It's been quite critical of what's going on in Syria, which I can certainly understand. So I believe that Turkey in the future is going to continue to be increasingly influential in a beneficial way in the Middle Eastern region. They are antagonistic toward Iran, as you know. They are fairly compatible with Egypt. They're fairly compatible in the past with Israel until they had an altercation about the ship a couple of years ago. So I think in general, to answer your question, Turkey is playing a strong role. It's going to increase. I think it'll be a moderating and positive factor.
Thank you. I'm going to turn now to the Carter Center. Can the Carter Center do anything to improve human rights and diplomacy for peace here in the United States? With the help of the Carter Center and the passage of time, much has improved abroad. What can the Carter Center do to improve U.S. policies here in the United States?
Well, I would say that the Carter Center takes an idealistic, you might want to call it a naive approach to human rights, excuse me, because we have publicly come out against the unlimited use of drones to assassinate people without trial and without any judicial oversight. We faced the same basic problem when I was president, and we passed what's called FISA, which established a group of senior judges who could act very expeditiously if the CIA or any other intelligence agency wanted to tap your telephone. And if the executive branch wanted to tap your telephone, they had to go to this FISA court, who would then decide yes or no. I think that's something that President Obama might want to consider in the future, is either a blue ribbon commission, maybe not having to be judges, that is in the judicial system, but having some way to monitor to make sure that this is not abused, because we've now killed four Americans overseas. One of them was a member of Al-Qaeda. He wasn't threatening immediate attacks on the United States, but long term. His 16-year-old son was also killed and two other Americans. So I would like to see some very tight restraints that America, private citizens like you and me, and the Congress could understand this is a procedure that's being used, and if an American is assassinated by a drone, that has been the control of it. We are very much against the death penalty. As a matter of principle, I would like to see the death penalty eliminated. As a matter of fact, when I happened to be governor and happened to be president, nobody was executed because the Supreme Court at that time had put a hold on all capital punishment impositions. And I wrote an op-ed piece that was in the LA Times when you were getting ready to vote recently on whether or not California would continue with the death penalty. I was against it. You voted to keep it. And one of the things I pointed out was that you have executed, I think, 13 people in the last 15 or 20 years, and the average cost per person executed by California has been $307 million. So that's how much you spend every time you execute a person. And my own belief is that the threat of the death penalty is not a deterrent to crime, and I put a lot of things in my editorial about it. If you want to look those two editorials up against the drones and against the death penalty, you can do that. But the Carter Center works with human rights organizations all over the world. We work with Amnesty International, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, a whole gamut of them, and every year we have a what we call a defenders conference, where we bring in human rights defenders or human rights heroes to the Carter Center to consider a key issue. This year, the issue will be women's rights. And we're going to go to Cairo. We're going to Cairo, Egypt, to have the conference. It'll be in June. And we'll have human rights heroes come from 40-something, 45 countries, plus religious leaders who will come to Cairo to meet with us. And we've got a support not only from President Morsi, whom I've just mentioned to you, but also from the Grand Imam of so-called Al-Azhar. Al-Azhar is the university in Cairo that has 120,000 students, and he's the president of a university. He's also the number one Sunni Muslim on earth. He's the one that gives the philosophy or the interpretation of the scriptures for the Sunni Muslims, and he's helping us with our conference because he wants to see religion stop being a cause of abuse of women. There's no doubt in my mind. There's no doubt in my mind that this is the case, because I was a Southern Baptist until the year 2000, when my wife and I withdrew in protest when the Southern Baptist derogated women to a subordinate position. A woman now in the Southern Baptist Convention, for instance, can't be a preacher, she can't be a deacon, she can't even, if she is in a Southern Baptist seminary, she can't even teach male students. And as you know, the Catholic Church does not let women be priests, and the Islamic world also derogates women in some cases. And in Saudi Arabia, a woman can't drive a car. And I think that when a men are inclined to abuse women, the best excuse they can make is, well, if God doesn't consider a woman to be equal to man, why should I treat my wife as my equal? Why should I treat my women employees as equal to a male employee if God thinks that women are inferior? So this is a basic thrust of a conference in June, and that's the kind of things that the Carter Center does on drones and on the death penalty and on women's rights and so forth in human rights.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on AccessSacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Was it Cesar Chavez or Rosa Parks that day? Some say Dr. King or Gandhi that set them on their way. No matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see that if you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand. Put singing and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine.
Hey, you law-abiding citizens, come listen to this song. Laws are made by people, and people can be wrong. Once unions were against the law, but slavery was fine. Women were denied the vote while the children were the mine, yeah.
The more you study history, the less you can deny it.
Say a rotten law stays on the books till folks with guts defy it.
Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand. Cause sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine.
Well, the law's supposed to serve us, and so are the police. But when the system fails, it's up to us to speak our peace.
We must be ever vigilant for justice to prevail.
So get courage from your convictions, let them haul you off to jail.
Have you been to jail for justice? Won't shake your hand. Cause sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine. Have you been to jail for justice?
Have you been to jail for justice?
Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine.
And Once again, here is President Jimmy Carter.
A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is President Jimmy Carter. This questionnaire in the audience says, I participated in the guinea worm eradication program in Ghana, and thank you for your work. How did you come to learn of guinea worm, and what gave you and the Carter Center the hope that it could be eradicated?
My drug czar in the White House was a man named Dr. Peter Bourne. And when he and I both left the White House, he went to the United Nations and became Assistant Secretary of Secretary General of the United Nations. And he was assigned the responsibility for the decade of water. And so his charge was to analyze the impact of water on people's health and well-being. And he found that this particular disease was one of the worst diseases that came out of water, and it was not addressed by anybody else because it was so intractable and so widespread and so uncertain. So he came to the Carter Center and made us talk to us one day. And so then we decided to do it. And right next door to the Carter Center is a Centers for Disease Control. And so we were able to steal the best people out of the Centers for Disease Control, because one of the men there, Dr. Don Hopkins, was working on guinea worm. He had been instrumental in eradicating smallpox earlier, and he wanted to come and work full-time on this project. He couldn't do it in CDC, but he could do it at the Carter Center. So that's how we got involved in it. So we started a tour of the world. I did personally. I went first to Pakistan and then to Yemen and then to India and then all across Canada, and we found the countries that did have guinea worm, and that's when we started eradicating it one by one. There's zero cases in Ghana anymore, and there's zero cases in 17 of the countries. In fact, of the 542 cases, 521 of those cases are in southern Sudan, and the rest of the world only has 21 cases. And we know every case and every village, and we have every one of those people that have guinea worm now under our control so they don't go back in the water and start the disease all over again. So we're getting now very near to the end of guinea worm on Earth.
Mr. President, you recently met with the new Chinese leader.
Yes.
This questionnaire wants to know your impression of him and which direction he will lead China to. And can you tell us how you look at the relationship between the U.S. and China, especially from the economy and human rights perspectives?
As I first visited China in 1949, I was on a submarine, and this was the last few weeks before the Nationalist Chinese left the mainland and the Communist Chinese took over. And so I've had a very high interest in China ever since. When I became president, we had been 35 years alienated from China, and our diplomatic relations was only with Taiwan. And I decided that I would normalize relations with China. We were able to do that, and it was announced the 15th day of December 1978, and it took effect the first day of 1979. Anyway, since then, I've gone to China quite often. The Chinese government trusts me and the Carter Center in an extraordinary way. For instance, they have authorized the Carter Center with a contract with the government to monitor all the 650,000 villages in China, and they are purely democratic elections. Everybody in those little villages is automatically registered to vote when they reach the age of 18. They have a secret ballot. The candidates can run for office whether they're communist or not, and most of them are not members of the Communist Party. They can run for re-election after 3 years and that sort of thing. So the Carter Center has monitored that for 15 years. We also are helping the Chinese now with their relationship with African countries, and we also are helping the Chinese implement a freedom of information law to let the people of China know what their government is doing. And the Chinese government, by the way, calls on us to do this. Xi Jinping has been a friend of mine for many years. I've met four different times with Xi Jinping since I knew that he was going to be the next leader of China, and he will be ordained next month when the National People's Congress convenes. He's been to the United States once. And when I've also met with Li Keqiang, who will be the vice premier of China beginning next month. So I know the Chinese leaders very well. When I was there in December for the last time 2 months ago, they were very deeply concerned about the attitude of the United States toward them with the new move by President Obama to the Pacific and with the stationing of 2,500 Marines in Australia and things like that. I need not go into detail about it. But also they had a windmill project in Oregon, and President Obama declared that the windmill project of China would be a threat to our security. So some of those things and the rhetoric that you heard heard from Governor Romney and also to a lesser degree from President Obama in the last election, the Chinese monitor every one of those words, and they try to interpret what these candidates mean in their attitude toward China. So China is very concerned about the attitude of America toward them in the future. I think we're going to be competitive in many ways. When I travel around the world, and my wife and I have been to more than 140 countries, now you see that the Chinese are very influential all over Africa, all over Latin America, and I think are forming contracts for politics and for economic benefits. I think in the future, China wants to stay peaceful. I mentioned just a list of wars that we have been in since the since the Second World War a while ago. It's a long list, and I didn't name them all. When I normalized relations with Deng Xiaoping, the next morning, by the way, when he met with me, he said he had a secret message he had to give me that China was going to invade Vietnam. And I said, don't do it, because, you know, you and I have just formed a peace agreement for the first time, and the first thing you do is to invade another country. It shows that we're not peaceful in nature. He said, well, we'll be there just to punish Vietnam, because we have to do it as a matter of honor. And I said, well, if you will, do me a favor, don't stay very long. And he said, okay. And so they were only in Vietnam 2 weeks, and then they withdrew. That was in 1979. The Chinese have not been at war since 1979. So they're worried about this. But I think we're going to have to, I think that the best way for us to compete with China and win, if we want to have a victor or a loser, is for us to adhere to the principles that I mentioned earlier of peace and justice and democracy and freedom and environment and that sort of thing. So that's what I think we should do to compete with them successfully. There's no way that China's going to ever threaten the United States militarily. And I don't think they're ever going to threaten the United States politically either, unless they change and make the democracy that exists in their little villages prevail in their big cities and counties and provinces. I should point out very quickly that the little villages are not part of the Communist Party system. They're completely separate. The Communist Party starts at what they call townships, which is big cities, and then goes to counties and provinces. So I think eventually China is going to continue to move toward more democracy. I hope that Xi Jinping will bring that about. There's been a setback recently on Hu Jintao, but I believe that in the future we're going to see more freedom go to China. Right now, for instance, compared to when we normalized relations, China has made great strides toward human rights. When I normalized diplomatic relations with China, they had no freedom of religion. It was against the law to own a Bible. Now, the largest Bible-producing company on earth is in China, and the fastest-growing Christian country on earth is China. So they've made some progress, not enough. We've made a lot of progress, not enough. Both of us can improve toward all of those nice things that I mentioned earlier.
Mr. President, moving a little closer to home, and I know before you came here, we were talking about your favorite for the Academy Awards Best Picture tonight. So there were a number of questions. Let me try to roll them into one. There's been a bit of controversy relating to the movie Argo over the role played by Canadian Ambassador Ken Taylor and his embassy staff versus that played by the CIA in shepherding six U.S. diplomats to freedom during the 79 hostage crisis. Can you shed some light on these events? And are there any events that weren't captured in the movie that you can share with us?
Well, I was on the Piers Morgan show, and he's here in California to report on the Oscar presentations tonight, and that's why he concentrated on this particular issue. As a matter of fact, I was present when the hostages were taken in Iran, as most of you old enough would remember, and I was informed immediately that six of our hostages were not taken in the compound by the Iranians. They escaped. They went to two or three other places. And, for instance, the British and some others wouldn't take them in. So they finally wound up in the Canadian embassy and the DCM's office where they were taken in. And the Canadians were in great potential trouble then, because all of their diplomats could also have been taken hostage if they had been caught protecting Americans. And so Ken Taylor was the ambassador there. And Flora MacDonald was the foreign minister of Canada. I was faced with a very difficult position, too, because I wanted to keep it absolutely secret. And we finally worked out an agreement between the CIA and the Canadians that the American hostages would escape using Canadian passports. But you can imagine the difficulty, legally speaking, for the Canadian Parliament to issue false passports. So the entire Parliament had to go into secret session, the only time they've ever done that in history, and they did, and they voted to issue the six false passports. and they kept it secret. So the false passports went over there, and the hostages were permitted to leave.
USA! USA! What kind of revolution would you like to start?
Now for something completely different.